Nature and Role of Scientific Knowledge, Part 2, the eighth talk in a series on Foundations of Knowing the Truth, was presented by Charlie Dewberry on January 14, 1992, at McKinsey Study Center, an institute of Gutenberg College. The copyright for this recording is held by Gutenberg College, Inc., 2014. Gutenberg College is a nonprofit organization, and contributions may be made at www.gutenberg.edu. This material may be copied and distributed in whole for non-commercial and educational purposes, subject to the inclusion of this introduction. All other rights reserved. A brief break occurs in the middle of the following recording. It is the result of the original audio tape switching to the second side. The following recording was made in a classroom setting, and some of the students' questions were inaudible. It is hoped that Dr. Dewberry's answers will be sufficient to understand the context.
All right. Last week we started looking at the nature and role of scientific knowledge. Okay, where we left off last week was I basically asked you to think about a couple of things for this week. And those things were, what's the difference between the traditional model of the scientific method and the method of knowing that I outlined? And that's the first part of the last lecture. And on the notes for this week, those are A and B under number one. That's what we're going to look at first, is we're going to take kind of a close look and point out what the differences are between the traditional scientific method and the method of knowing I outlined. The second question we're going to address a little bit tonight is how we can reconcile those two views. How might we go about trying to make sense out of basically a difference we see? And lastly, I pose this question about relative motion. And the example I used last time was, we have a couple of boats out on the ocean, and the question was, how is it that we could know that one boat may be moving or not moving relative to the Earth? In other words, relative to the bottom of the ocean. So relative to a grid system on the Earth. So obviously what I have in mind here is, obviously if this ship is just kind of sitting in what looks like flat water and this one kind of has a wake, your assumption would be this ship is not moving and this ship is moving through the water. But our problem is what happens if the water is actually moving relative to the floor of the ocean? So that's the kind of question I wanted to raise, is when we think about motion of things, how is it that we actually know something's moving and not stationary relative to, say, the Earth? Those were the questions that I posed last week, and we're going to begin to work our way through those. And the first thing we're going to do is we're going to make a comparison of the scientific method with our ordinary method of knowing. Okay, and I have them outlined here in A and B. And I'm not going to write them all out, but what I will do is just kind of list them with a little code here, and then we'll talk about them. So first, I claimed our ordinary way of knowing, we begin with pre-understanding. And then two, we notice that something interests us, so something catches our eye somehow. Okay, and then three, we try to come up with explanations. Four, we find a possible candidate. Okay, five, we validate or somehow decide that that's correct. And six, our worldview has changed. And also, just what I claimed last time is that normally we do this process tacitly, meaning we're just not conscious of doing it. But this is what we actually do every step of the way. But it's just, we don't think about that process. We don't focus on it really happening. So it kind of occurs subconsciously. Secondly, it's a skill that we've learned how to do. And we've learned how to do that most of our lives. We've started out with very simple little things, learning them, and then having that understanding, that pre-understanding, and then learning more. And over time, learning to do this process And since it's a skill, one of the things I claimed in the last mini course is that it's something we can reflect on and become much better at. As I say, it's a skill, so it's something you can learn, something you can focus on and become better at. Now, the scientific method. Now again, this is the scientific method that I'm basically outlining on the board, I think, is what I would call the traditional method. And at least for most of my education, this was the one that was in most of the textbooks, and it basically was the one that I was taught. This is what you basically do when you do research. And although there's been some differences of late, the traditional model is still very much alive and well. As we found out last time when I asked several people who were doing undergrad studies in the sciences whether or not this traditional model that I articulated, whether or not that was familiar to them, and basically all the undergrads still said, oh yeah, that's very familiar to me. That's basically what I've been taught. And this method is start out with a hypothesis. And then once we have our hypothesis, we make deductions from that hypothesis. So what we do is we say, well, if this hypothesis is true, then under this set of circumstances, this ought to happen. And under this set of circumstances, something else ought to happen. But if this hypothesis is true, then given these kind of conditions, we can make predictions on what ought to happen in those particular cases. So those are called deductions. Okay, then three, we test our hypothesis by what's called the null hypothesis. And I explained a bit of that last time, where you basically take the opposite of the hypothesis and you disprove it. And so when you test, you get results and you can falsify, but you can never claim it's true. You can say it's well tested and current science believes it to be true. Just a minute, let me get through it. But scientists will be very careful here never to claim that their knowledge is true. It's always possible that they're going to find cases or experiments that they'll do which will actually falsify their hypothesis. Okay, and so the last part of this view is that basically what science is small continuous steps. That as we do these little tests, we'll build pieces that have been severely tested and we think have been severely tested, and those are the building blocks that we start to accumulate, and that's scientific knowledge. So this is the process by which science progresses. Oh, okay, go ahead.
I don't totally understand the test null hypothesis.
Okay.
Null hypothesis, I'm not. What would be the opposite and
okay.
Four?
All right. The one I used last week, the hypothesis was plants need nitrogen. Okay, that's our hypothesis. Okay, now how a scientist would go about testing this hypothesis is this. He would take what's called the null hypothesis, and he would say plants do not need nitrogen. Okay, so that's the null hypothesis. Now you do the experiment. So plants do not need nitrogen. So your prediction is that if you grow plants, here's a pot, if you grow plants with no nitrogen, let's say 5 units of nitrogen and 10 units of nitrogen. Okay, you plant little seedlings in here. Okay, and so here's your experiment. Your prediction is that if plants do not need nitrogen, all of these plants will grow the same amount. Okay? Now, let's say we do the experiment and this plant doesn't grow at all. In fact, it kind of turns yellow and kind of dies. This plant grows about this much, and this plant grows about this much. Okay? Now, what the scientist would say is, this data set causes us to reject this hypothesis. Okay? This null hypothesis. Okay? This is wrong. So we've falsified this. Okay? We've shown this to be false. So that means it's possible that the opposite of it then is true. Mm-hmm. Now, why would they do this kind of... It seems strange. Why don't you just test your hypothesis and see if it works or not? Well, see, what's bugging the scientist here a bit is what's called a problem of induction. And how it works, I think you're actually familiar with it. But but it kind of goes like this. Let's say every time you go outside, every time you go out the door, you see a blue Ford come by. Okay? So you walk out the door, and you see a blue Ford. Okay? Now you walk out the door a second time, and you see a blue Ford. Okay? And you walk out a third time, and you see a blue Ford. So you say, every time I walk outside, there's going to be a blue Ford coming by. That's what I've learned here. I mean, doesn't that make sense? Well, see, that's kind of how induction works. And I mean, we use it all the time. But yet, we know that if we kind of go out here about one more time, there's going to be a red Chevy. I mean, we just know that's kind of going to happen. So see, what's happening when we do an experiment, all we're doing is making one observation. And it could be just random chance that got us those results. So see, what a scientist recognizes is this kind of stuff where we go out here and we make observations, that when we go out and make an observation, it could just be a fluke that we get it. So we got to go out here and we got to do it a couple times. And after we do it a few times, that kind of leads us to believe that there is something in fact really going on here. Mm-hmm. But the problem is, with this kind of approach, stringing together these observations into a generalization, okay, that can get us into trouble. Because
like the American car, like if you walk outside...
Well, because the reason it could get us in trouble is there's an N number of possibilities here, and we've only seen three. Well, maybe we just saw three random shots. Well, and we would guess that the example I gave you is three random shots. Well, but yet, all of us are taking pieces of data like this, and we're making generalizations out of them, okay? And we think those generalizations are true. But see, what the scientist is saying, when they test this once, and when you tested this once, you said, now wait a minute. I mean, when I came out the door, there was a blue Ford going by. So let's just say you thought that was a little funny. So you go out and try it again, and you get another blue Ford. And you go, well, that's just kind of weird. But I got another blue Ford. Well, you do it again and you get a blue Ford. See, there comes a point here when you start stringing these together, and if you get blue Fords all the time, then you naturally kind of come to the conclusion that the generalization that when I walk out the door, there's going to be a blue Ford coming by, you become convinced that's true. But the problem with this kind of method is you only have N number of cases here, and there's a whole bunch of possibilities. So that's what's worrying the scientist. So what they're saying is this. If you come by, and your hypothesis is there'll always be a blue Ford coming by, okay? But the null hypothesis is there will not be a blue Ford coming by. Well, the first time you see, first case you get where there's not a blue Ford coming by, you know this hypothesis is wrong. You've falsified it. Okay, so see, that's what they're thinking. That's why this kind of convoluted, what will seem convoluted.
So what happens when he walks outside and he gets the null hypothesis? He walks outside and a blue Ford goes by.
Okay, the null hypothesis is a blue Ford will not be going by. Okay? So he steps outdoors and sees a blue Ford go by. So this hypothesis that a blue Ford will not go by is obviously wrong. So we falsified that. We know it's wrong. So that means our original hypothesis that a blue Ford will be going by could be right. But the point is, we never could know for sure that it's always going to be right. All we know is we've tested that. And so far, we've always gotten a blue Ford going by. We've always been able to reject this hypothesis. And that's all we can say. So after three times, we could say, well, we've tested this sucker three times now, and we reject the null hypothesis that a blue Ford will not be going by. So our hypothesis that there is a blue Ford going by has been severely tested, and it's held up so far. But we are aware that the next case may falsify that generalization. Okay? Now, yeah, that seems very strange to us, and that's one of the major things I want to talk about, is what's going on here? What's behind, really, this kind of a scheme? Why do they think you can only falsify? And a large part of the reason I've just told you is because, for them, they have a real problem with this notion of induction, this idea that you can go from particulars to a generalization. That's a real problem for them, because they can give no justification at all for why it works. And so the only thing they can do is come up with a scheme like this, which allows them to use this method to say we can falsify something and show that something's been tested severely, but we never could say it's true, not by induction. We never could claim anything's true by induction. Okay, maybe I'll do this step right now. I'll take care of this right now. I was going to do it later, but I'll do it right now. See, what's behind this system is this. Is last week I said, what's behind this method is the notion that the knowledge that a scientist gets is more certain and it's more objective than the kind of knowledge you get over here. See, the scientist is after certain objective knowledge, which is qualitatively different from what everybody else has got. That's why we look to scientists in this sense, basically Copernicus. That's why scientists have become the holders of knowledge, the real torchbearers of knowledge. And in fact, we saw last week that in fact science even replaced philosophy. Philosophy essentially became a subset under science. And in fact, in the beginning of the 20th century, all of philosophy was really looked at as a subset of science, just a way to learn how to express philosophical ideas in scientific language. That was the whole endeavor of philosophy. So what's at stake here, see, is the assumption is made that by using this method, here's what you're going to get. You're going to get certain knowledge. And by that, they mean knowledge are things that are absolutely true. You couldn't be wrong about them. That's what knowledge is. Okay, now over here, that's not what we mean by knowledge. Okay, what we mean by knowledge over here is when we claim to know something, all we're really claiming about it is we believe it's true to such an extent that we're going to live our life as if it's true. That's what we mean by knowledge. We believe that it's true. And so true knowledge then are beliefs we hold that we think correspond to reality. True knowledge, those beliefs do in fact correspond to the way the world really is. And so that's what we mean by knowledge over here. So see, the first thing I want to point out is, see, this method is looking, this method is designed to give us a different kind of knowledge, a more certain knowledge. That's its purpose. That's why this convoluted system. Why? Because, see, you've got to cover all these possibilities to the point where there isn't anyone that could come out here and ambush you. But certain knowledge, it's got to work every time. And if you find one case where it doesn't work, then you falsified it as far as certain knowledge is concerned. Okay? Does that make sense?
Is one evil and one is better, or is it for different purposes?
Hold on to that, because that's kind of where we're going. Okay. Does everybody kind of follow what's going on here? Yeah. But in this view, what they would claim is this, and I'm not going to go a long ways into this, but I'll go part way just to give you an answer. You see, what people do is propose a theory, and a theory makes predictions within this box, like a whole bunch of things are going to be true. Okay, so a theory tells us a whole bunch of things about the world. And then we start using this method, and we find that, lo and behold, this is stuff that we have not rejected. Okay, so we do our null hypothesis test, and we falsify our null hypotheses, and we start accumulating stuff that we haven't been able to falsify yet. Okay, let's say in this case, we got this amount of stuff that we've tested now, and we haven't been able to falsify. So now let's say somebody comes along with theory 2. This system says that theory 2 has to explain all of the stuff we haven't rejected yet. But it can make other explanations for stuff that we haven't proven yet. So that this is how science actually works. We start out with a theory, so we'll have a theory of sorts. But see, we're just using the theory as a framework to begin to build our set of stuff we haven't falsified. And then we'll build this second theory, which is it's a different way of looking at it, but it'll allow us to build out here now. So let's say we get this, okay? True scientific progress for the people of this view is only what's in this hat-shaped box. That's the progress of science. The theory, see, is just a convenient way of framing this thing so it's got some order to it as you begin to string this stuff together. So the progress of science is the accumulation of this stuff that has been severely tested and not rejected. Okay? Now, like I say, why this is of interest is because these people start out by saying, What characterizes science, what makes it different from other endeavors, is science progresses in its knowledge. And that isn't true of other methods of gaining knowledge. But science is always progressive. So it's always building by accumulating this stuff that hasn't been falsified. And after n number of tests, it's viewed as pretty solid, that it's not going to be falsified. And so they wouldn't ever expect that one of these down here that's been severely tested over long periods of time. I mean, we just don't think those are ever going to be falsified, and they don't think they will be. Okay? So this is kind of the view that's over here. And that's one of the major differences, is they have a different understanding of what knowledge is. And they're claiming that this method gives them more certain knowledge than you can ever get over here. Okay? And that's the primary foundation of why scientists, either themselves or in the eyes of others, have put them on the pedestal as the real keepers of knowledge, as the real apostles of knowledge, if you will, for the culture. Okay, so I was going to do that later, so I hope that doesn't kind of mix you up. But see, that's why that null hypothesis method is so important, is because you've got to have certainty. Okay, now let me back up for a second. Okay, now let me back up, go through these step by step, and pull out the differences. Well, the first thing we see that here, hypotheses are what we begin in the traditional model. Over here we've got pre-understanding. Well, there's nothing that corresponds here. So we have a hole. Let's just put a block around this. Now we have a hypothesis over here. Now, the traditional kind of hardcore version of this would say, now, with regards to hypotheses, we really don't know where one comes from. Just shot out of the blue. Just comes to somebody to look at this. There's no reason for it. There is a reason for it. It's outside of science. Now, why would they want to make that kind of claim? And the reason is they have to make that kind of claim. Because if they don't make that claim, then where could it come from? And the only answer is pre-understanding, and that's the very biases they're trying to get away from. See, you've got to come up with a method that sets aside all your biases and pre-understanding. That's the foundation of any kind of method that's going to get you a qualitatively different kind of truth of knowledge. So the point is, right here, hypotheses, they just come out of the blue. What makes a good scientist? They made a lucky guess on what to look at. No hypothesis is better than any other hypothesis. They just lucked out. Well, that is the view. It's articulated, and a lot of the textbooks will still flat out say that. Now, there are changes being made now, a few, but traditionally that's been the view, because they recognize that if the purpose of the scientific method is to lead to a scientist being detached and objective, then that has to be the case, because nothing up here could get in the process. If anything up here gets in the process, then that's nulling and voiding your claim to something different here. Okay, so hypotheses. Well, that really corresponds to something catches our eye. Explain this. So we think, well, in this set of circumstances, this might explain it. In this set of circumstances, well, that might explain it. Well, that's the same deductive principle. It's here. That's the same thing. If you remember when we were over here, what we do is we have a hypothesis and we say, in this set of circumstances, this is going to happen. In this set of circumstances, something else will happen. And those are the things we're making predictions about. So what I want to claim is basically, this step is the same also. Now, in our everyday stuff, when we come down to validating it, what we claim is, you know, we just may think of an explanation. And we go, yeah, that makes sense. Yeah, that's probably it. And so that's good enough. Or if it's something that really kind of interests you and it really kind of makes a difference, you might say, well, you know, I think I want to look at this a little more. I want to test it out. So you start doing either thought experiments, or you might even set up a little physical experiment to test this idea that you've come up with. See if it works. And the point is you set up an experiment that if you get A, then you know this turned out true, but if you get B, then it turns out false. You're looking for an experiment that's going to clearly give you a true or false. So you set up a little experiment like that and do it. And if you do it, you think it's true. So if you do it and it works, you think, yeah, that's it. That explains it. And as a result, your worldview has changed, which means you have now a new set of pre-understanding. Okay? Now, when we come over here for validation, okay, we're sort of doing the same thing, meaning we've got this deduction now. We somehow want to test it. We want to validate it. Well, over here, we just went through that, the null hypothesis. Over here, we're just trying to decide if we think it's true or false or not. Over here, you can only falsify. Okay? And then the results of that experiment is you can only falsify. You can never claim to know anything truly. If you listen closely to scientists, if they're consistent, they'll usually always hedge and say, well, all the data we got so far seems to indicate X. Or, well, some of them will say, well, we've tested this severely, and at this point we haven't rejected X. But it will always be along those lines. Those are the results. And you never can show that it's true. You can only show that it hasn't been falsified, that it hasn't been rejected yet. So over here, science, if you will, builds by these little steps that accumulate over time, and this is the progress of science. Now over here, although that's true, that you know, within pre-understanding, we can build little pieces of knowledge, and we build things, and we accumulate knowledge within our pre-understanding, and our pre-understanding will float along for quite a little while, and you know, we're just kind of accumulating data. You know, we're just kind of getting a bigger picture of just more kinds of things that fit within our picture. But there's also something else that sometimes happens. Sometimes we find ourselves in a situation where we've got some data, but all of a sudden we're aware that the way we've been looking at the data, there seems to be kind of a problem with it. Or there's another way of looking at the same piece of data that gives you a totally different picture. Now, for those of you who were here last term, I show the ambiguous woman. I think everybody has seen that now. That there's that figure of the ambiguous woman. All the data is the same. I mean, the data is the same. It's the same Xerox sheet. And yet some people are going to see a young woman, some people are going to see an old woman. Now, what this view says is not only can you accumulate little data like this, but once in a while, when we validate something or we get in one of these cases where we're working through and trying to validate, we find that it's actually a case that takes all our data and puts it into a new picture. We might call it a conversion experience. And in fact, that's the way it's often talked about. Is you'll have all this experience and you'll have a view of the world and all of a sudden you'll go through a conversion experience where you just see the world differently. You have a new picture of the world. Now over here, that kind of thing can happen. In the traditional model, for most of the 20th century in science, that was not the case over here. In fact, the people that write over here will say some interesting things, which I'll talk about later. I'll flesh it out a little more, but they'll always talk about the progress of science is always something that's continuous. So for example, a big battle is fought over whether Darwinian evolution is actually a revolution, like I was talking about a shift here, or whether or not it's just stringing along a continuum of something that's been going for a long time. Is there really continuity all the way through biology, all the way through Darwin, or is Darwin a revolutionary shift in the way we look at biology? Well, the people that hold this traditional model, they don't want to talk about Darwinian evolution as being a revolution. No, it was a little turn, but the point is it's just accumulation of data that finally got us that far, that got us that model. But it's totally in line with all that went before it. See, it's not a revolution. It's just sort of a shift. There's continuity here. So these folks that are over here will always be emphasizing the continuity. Well, because for them, progress in science is these accumulated pieces of data that this is what science is. Well, see, the problem is if you're going to claim this is exactly progress in science, then what could you say? Okay, I'll tell you what the other people want to say. The other people want to say that when you go through a revolution, when you go through a shift, some of these things you thought were true and were interesting to you, they aren't going to be interesting anymore. See, there's no progress in science. There's no truth gain in science. Science just evolves from one paradigm to the next. No paradigm is more true than any other paradigm. It's just it's more evolved. So see, when you go through a paradigm shift, some stuff over here that you thought was true, that you thought was verified, well, it's either uninteresting to you anymore, or if you do the experiments, given your new view, they'll actually be false in this new case. Now, that's the battle that started in 1960s. I'll explain more of that next week. And that's kind of next week's lecture. But that's kind of what's at stake here. But in at least in the model I was giving us over here, all I want to point out is revolutions like this, what we call major shifts in worldviews, those are possible. And we call them conversion experiences. So, I mean, we can think of lots of those kinds, that those are possible over here. But in this traditional model, those aren't possible. And the reason is because it's this accumulation of data, not how it's put together in some kind of theory. It's the accumulated data itself that's the progress of science. And science does progress. We know more now than Copernicus did. And all these data bits we got from Copernicus to now, that's what science is. Okay? Let me see if I hit all I wanted to hit here. Okay. So basically, I talked about the major difference here being pre-understanding on this side. In this model, its goal is to get rid of that. Basically, these two steps are the same. Again, we have this difference in test. And the reason we have the difference in test is because there's a different claim made as to what kind of knowledge we're going to get. Okay, and then here, you can have worldview changes, and some of them can be major shifts. Where over here, everything's kind of continuous. It just builds. Accumulated set of data just keeps building. Okay? Now, in order to look at kind of the next step of this, what I want to do now is go to what I think is probably one of the most ingenious and novel and simple little science experiments that mankind has ever kind of had to deal with. But it really highlights and brings out all that's at stake right here. And basically, that's just the simple question of how do we make sense out of the planets, the Earth, and the Sun? How do they move? Since certainly by the time of the Greeks and probably from the time man was in the garden, we've been trying to work on that one. If you just at night watch the heavens and watch them over time, you'll see that there are these things called planets, and in Greek they mean wanderers, things that wander through the sky. Well, what are those things that just move? And they move in kind of weird patterns. What are those, and how do we explain them? Because see, part of what's at stake there is explaining how our world's put together and where we fit in it. And it, as I say, it's a simple little experiment. All you got is like four or five little balls, and you're just trying to figure out how they move. It's a very simple little problem. But I think within this simple little problem, in working out our simple little problem, I think it raises all the issues that we need to resolve or to put together and reconcile our ordinary view of knowledge and the traditional view of science over here. So that's where we're going to go next. May not get all the way through this tonight. I'm just developing the Copernican example a little bit. But what I want to do is just kind of lay out what's at stake, because basically everyone points at Copernicus as the father of modern science. Well, the question I want to raise is, one, what did he do? Did he do this model over here, or did he do this model over here, or did he do something else? And that's one question. The second question I want to raise is let's take our traditional model of science. Let's take that model and let's look at the example of Copernicus and see what happens. What should we conclude if we use this model of science, looking at the Copernican revolution? That's the example I'm going to work through in the next 2 weeks, this week and next. Okay, what's basically the problem? Well, throughout history, there's sort of been two views, one of them more common than the other. One view says that the sun goes around the earth. And so we'll put the earth here. So the sun goes around the earth. And that makes a lot of sense. Our experience, all our data tells us that's the way it is. We know that the earth doesn't move. If it did, we'd fly off the sucker. All the data of our senses tells us it's steady. It's the sun that moves. And so actually, for most of history and for most people, this is the view they've held. Because that's basically what the data of your senses tells you. The other view proposed by Copernicus is that the sun's the center and the earth is actually moving in an orbit around the sun. I mean, we all know this. Well, the question that's been proposed off and on throughout history, and it's actually oscillated back and forth a few times, there were Greeks that believed this. It wasn't new with Copernicus. In fact, he went back and read the Greeks and said, they brought it up. That's why I started thinking about it as a possibility. Could it be possible that this is true? Consider it and see if it is. But at the time Copernicus was beginning to work on the problem, this was the view. This view says that all the planets go around the Earth. This is the view that Ptolemy had, that the Earth sits in the center and all these planets and the Sun go around the Earth. Okay? Now, we all know what the view is over here. The interesting thing I want to point out is that there's several interesting things about looking back at just this case when Ptolemy's view had been held for a very long time. It had been held for roughly 1,500 years. It had been the predominant view. Very few people had ever said this. Well, the folktale that we've heard about this is, well, Copernicus proposed this new system, and everybody just kind of looked at it and said, yeah, well, this is better. I mean, it's more accurate, gets rid of a whole bunch of apparatus that these guys had created over here to make the whole thing work. And actually, the only people that were against it was the church, the view you get. Well, the interesting thing when you start to look at it, and look at it in any detail, is that ain't the way it was at all. Because one, there wasn't enough data on either side to make it clear what was going on. Two, these kind of apparatus that were pointed at as being over here that were all bad. At the time, Copernicus had just as many. In fact, he might have had a few more. Last thing, if you look at the mathematical computations that are used in the two systems to predict where the planets are going to be by standing here on Earth, you know, you can kind of plot it out here and working it out here, is that the math of the two is entirely different, but they both work equally well. In fact, to be honest, most of the time when you look at where the planets are going to be located from Earth, in even current textbooks, everybody uses Ptolemy's math to figure it out because it's simpler. So that's the way it is. So the question is, now that all of a sudden I begin to find interesting, is, well, now wait a minute. What really happened here? And on what basis is Copernicus claiming that his system is true? Because what I just said is, they had no empirical data which could differentiate these two systems. They could all make equal predictions on what phenomena would happen. They'd work equally well. I mean, they explained them differently, but all the predictions were the same. And it was interesting to me that when I looked, Copernicus was not claiming that it was empirical evidence that was the reason he thought this was true. And that to me is very interesting, because if Copernicus is the father of modern science, what Copernicus founded was not empirical science that was based on this model over here at all. That isn't what he did. And in fact, that's not what he claimed at all. See, I think I'm just about out of time. Is this it? I think what I'll do is stop right here, and we'll come back and talk about this next week, and we'll talk about the last piece that I have here on the philosophy of science and the critique of the traditional model. What I'll do when I first come in next time is I'll give you the two critiques by the philosophers of science against the traditional model. But when I do that, we're always going to have in mind that these two systems by Thomas Kuhn and by Michael Polanyi, they're both going to be referring right to this situation. This is going to be the paradigm that they're going to use to throw rocks at the traditional model. See, they claim the traditional model never worked. Nobody ever did that. Nobody could do it. It's never worked in science. That's been the battle in philosophy of science since the 1960s. And so we're going to look at that a little bit, but then we're going to come back here and we're going to try to answer the question, was Copernicus justified in claiming to know his theory was true? He did. Well, there's some argument about whether he did, but the mathematician who worked with him the last few years was totally appalled when anybody said that he hadn't claimed his theory was true. And Galileo, Kepler, and ultimately Newton had to assume this was true to do any of their work. Well, the question is, on what basis could they claim this was true? That's what we're going to come back and look at. And I'm going to, at the end of next time, try to tell you whether or not I think Copernicus was justified in making that claim, and whether or not it was actually true. I'll try to do that next time, or at least I'll tell you what I think now. So we'll see if you agree with me. Anyway, that's it for tonight.